Senate Subcommittee on Elections will come to order. A quorum is present. Senator Hoffman moves the Thursday, February 26 minutes that are in members' packets. Is there any discussion on the minutes? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes and the minutes are adopted. So to those of you in the committee, there's the Judiciary Committee is meeting right now, of which other members on our committee are also on that one. And Senator Eakin has a bill up in the Judiciary Committee. So we're switching around the agenda a little bit. We'll start with Senator Hayden's bill right now, and then depending on if Senator Eakin gets here or not, move on to Senator Eakin's bill and then Senator Champion's bill. So Senator Hayden, Senate File 1151.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have Senate File 1151, the prison gerrymandering bill. As we know, each decade, Minnesota redraws its legislative districts on the basis of population to ensure that each district contains the same population as other districts. However, the Census Bureau practice of counting incarcerated people as residents of the prison location instead of their home community results in significant distortions in achieving fair representation. Traditionally, Minnesota Census Bureau data for redistricting purposes engage in prison-based gerrymandering. Even though Article 7, Section 2 of the Minnesota Constitution says that a person's residence does not change upon incarceration. Currently, there are 10 Minnesota house districts where state and federal prison populations were counted as residents during the last redistricting cycle, significantly enhancing the weight of a vote cast in those districts. Treating these people as constituents dilutes the votes of everyone who does not have a large prison population in their district. This legislation will require that we identify prison populations in any redistricting tables it publishes so that the inclusion of such populations could be taken into account by anyone reviewing the maps. Being aware of prison populations while drawing districts will also help minimize the vote. The vote's dilutive effect on prison-based gerrymandering because it makes it less likely that several large prisons are concentrated in the same district, as it will lessen the odds that a large prison will be placed within a district that's already underpopulated. Crediting all of Minnesota's incarcerated people to a few locations enhances political clout of the people who live near the prisons while dilutes the voting power of all other Minnesotans. Madam Chair, members, to discuss the bill further, I have Mark Hasse of the Second Chance Coalition.
Mr. Hasse, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Mark Hasse. My last name is spelled H-A-A-S-E, and I'm a steering committee member of the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition, which is a coalition of over 50 organizations that advocate for policies that allow people who have been convicted of a crime to redeem themselves, support themselves and their families, and contribute to their communities to their full potential. Regarding the bill, Senate File 1151, I don't have a lot to add outside of Senator Hayden's testimony or Senator Hayden's introduction. He introduced the basics of the bill. This is a little bit of a different bill for the Second Chance Coalition in that it doesn't actually directly impact people who have been incarcerated, and it has less of an impact on their families than many of the other policies that we advocate for. The impact, as you already heard, is really upon other voters throughout the state who, as you already heard, have their vote diluted based on the census count of people where they're incarcerated rather than where they are from. And it's just an example of how sometimes our policies it seems to me that this happens a lot in our criminal justice system, that there are unintended consequences that come out of the policies that impact not just people who commit crimes or accused of crimes and their families and the victims, but they also have a broader impact that sometimes we have to revisit that impact and see if there's ways to improve it. And I think this bill is a great example of that, and that's why the Second Chance Coalition supports it. And I'll answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Hasse. Are there any questions from the committee? The next person on the list is Jeremy Schrader from Common Cause, Minnesota. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Schrader.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeremy Schrader. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause, Minnesota. Thank you very much for having me here today. I am testifying in support of Senate File 1151 to end prison-based gerrymandering and to help stop the racial disparity in representation here in Minnesota. Currently, about 10,000 Minnesotans are incorrectly counted for purposes of representation as living where they are incarcerated instead of their home communities. And this has two very harmful effects. First, counting the prison populations as if they were actual constituents of the district and where the prison is located gives a few small communities political power at the expense of everyone else who does not live near a prison. The effect is that everyone who doesn't live in that district that contains a prison has their vote diluted by these artificially inflated populations. Second, counting prison populations in this way also creates a second and more serious problem here in Minnesota, in that if people are being counted in prison, they are not being counted in their home communities. 47% of people currently incarcerated are people of color, and which is a huge disparity with the 18.1% of people of color in Minnesota's current population. In turn, the communities in which the incarcerated live that are now underrepresented in terms of the size for every elected official, for city council all the way to the congressional representation. It is time to make our law more fair and to make sure all communities have equal representation and equal chance to have their voice heard. Thank you very much for your time. I ask for your support and yes vote on this bill, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Schrader. Any questions for him from the committee? Senator Hayden, it's my understanding that there's a little bit of problem with some language related to where the information is sent, whether it should be sent to the Secretary of State, but council says it should possibly be sent to the LCC. Are you...
So, Madam Chair, thank you for that. Yeah, we're working on that. That kind of came in late, so I think this bill is to be laid over, and so we're going to work on understanding and identifying that before we move.
And just to help clarify for the committee, it's regarding when the redistricting is done, it's not actually the Secretary of State's data that's used in that. It's the Legislative Coordinating Commission. So I think it's just a matter of transferring that information to the right institution or the LCC instead. So it shouldn't be that hard to fix. My intention, as we discussed, Senator Hayden, is to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And so then when we do bring up the omnibus bill, you could have your amendment ready, and the committee can discuss it at that time.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll work on that.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on Senate File 1151? Okay, so at this time we'll lay over Senate File 1151 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Senator Hayden.
So the next bill on the agenda is Senator Champion's Senate File 355. Senator Champion, I don't know if you've been before our election subcommittee before, so a very big welcome to you.
You know what, Madam Chair, let me first of all say thank you, thank you, thank you. And it's true, I've never been here before, so this is foreign territory to me, let me just say.
Senator Hoffman has something to add, I'm sure.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and I wish Senator Limmer was here, because, you know, when I first went in front of Senator Champion in the Judiciary Committee 2 years ago, they had said, "Where are the donuts?" And so Senator Champion, donuts do work well over here as well.
So. I'll remember that for the next time I come, great Senator. Well, thank you again, Madam Chair, for having me here today. The bill that's before you is one that is near and dear to my heart, and it's something that I hope that you all will see fit to pass. But I want to start by thanking my co-authors, Senator Brandon Peterson, Senator Eaton, Senator Thompson, and Senator Chamberlain, and also authors of a clone bill, Senate File 530, introduced by Senators Hall, Latz, Ingebrigtsen, Senator Benson, and Senator Sinjum. This matter that is before you and that is being considered under current law, I just want to be very clear that Minnesota Statute 609.165 says and states that in order for a person to vote now in the state of Minnesota, they have to be what we call off paper. That means they have to complete any probation or any parole. And those probationary periods can be very long, sometimes 10 years, 15 years, who knows, right? But this legislation would allow Minnesotans to vote upon completion of incarceration, if they ever have to go to prison or jail or anything, when they are living in our community, when they're out paying taxes and contributing to society, just like what is already being done in 13 other states. And just briefly, I'll tell you those 13 states: Hawaii, Illinois, Indiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, Montana, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Ohio, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Utah. And just to bring it back home to Minnesota, we have approximately 57,000 Minnesotans are unable to vote due to a felony conviction. And of that 57,000, 47,000, approximately 47,000, are living in the community. So they come from all over the state. One of the stats I like to talk about is, because people usually think that the majority of these folks come from urban corridors, but I would remind you that 64% of that 47,000 that's living in our community live outside of Hennepin and Ramsey County. Only 36% live in Hennepin and Ramsey County. That's important, because 33,000 are whites, 9,000 are African Americans, 3,000 are Hispanic, and 3,000 are Native American. So from our perspective, and we hope this committee will agree, is that there's no sound public policy reason to maintain Minnesota's policy of prohibiting people living in the community from voting. There's no evidence that improves public safety or provides any other benefit. In fact, on the contrary, there's evidence that allowing people in the community to vote improves public safety. Research links pro-social activities like voting to a decrease in crime. Empirical studies show some correlation between voting and lower recidivism. Additionally, research has shown that children, because we know that children are mirror images of the environment, according to most sociologists, is that children are more likely to vote as adults if they are raised by parents who engage in the voting process. That means that the negative effects of felony disenfranchisement, I always have a difficult time with that word for some reason, on public safety and racial disparities described above will have a deeper and longer effect if maintained. So we also believe, and I know that there's some election judges in the audience here today, is by having this notion where people are out and they are not incarcerated, it confuses elections. And that there's a significant financial cost. So our current system is confusing and often leaves people wondering when and if they are eligible to vote. And allowing people to vote when they are not incarcerated will create a bright line so we know who can and cannot vote. I hope that this committee will join over 55 Minnesota organizations that also support it. And a complete list is in your packet, and I hope you get a chance to take a look at it. But I'll just mention a couple that stick out. All are important, but I just thought I would just mention a couple. For an example, from the faith perspective, they include the Minnesota Catholic Conference, ISAIAH, and the Minnesota Council of Churches, Jewish Community Action, Muslims, the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. From the public safety and legal perspective, supporters include, and not limited to, criminal defense attorneys as well as reentry focus group, but correctional professionals represented by the Minnesota Community Corrections Association. And you also hear from Mike Freeman, who is with us today. And by the way, when he testified in the other committee, he was sitting there with me, and he's very happy that I didn't tap him on the wrong shoulder, because he was sitting there with a broken arm. And he was on his way to the hospital. I didn't do it, ladies and gentlemen. I just want you to know. I didn't do it. But we're excited that he's here and he's a supporter, and there's a wide array of direct service and advocacy groups that include the NAACP and just others. So I just want to thank you for this opportunity, and thank you to all those organizations that I mentioned and many others that are working on this change to our law. And I just want you to know that your work does not go unnoticed. And so with that being stated, I can go through the bill now, or if you would like to have the other testifiers. Madam Chair, it's up to you.
Senator Champion, first of all, I want to commend you and publicly thank you for your leadership on this issue. You've been working on it for a number of years very diligently, and I think that the broad group of supporters is a reflection of that hard work that you've put into this for throughout many years now. The governor, as some of you may know, the governor appointed a task force back in 2011. I know, Senator Champion, you were involved in that as long as others in the room. And I just think it's a testament to your leadership, former Secretary of State Richie's leadership on getting us to this point today where it passed through another committee and now we're hearing it here in this committee. So that's my soapbox statement for the committee now. Why don't you run through walk through the bill first, okay, and then we'll hear from the other testifiers.
All right, thank you. So Section 1 provides that an individual convicted of a felony is eligible to vote upon completion of any incarceration imposed and executed by the court. If the person is later incarcerated for the same offense, the individual's right to vote is lost only during the period of incarceration. And that's Section 1. And Section 2 is a conforming amendment that changes the voter registration application requirements to reflect the right of felons to vote under the circumstances provided in Section 1. Section 3 is a conforming a portion as well, requiring data provided by the Commission of Corrections to the Secretary of State for the purposes of determining the restoration of the right to vote of convicted felons. Section 4 requires the Secretary of State to develop an electronic publication with complete and accurate information about the voting rights of people who have been charged with or convicted of a crime. And this publication must be made available to, you know, state court administrators and a wide range of others, including judges and court personnel. Section 5 amends the Voters' Bill of Rights to reflect the right of convicted felons to vote, provided they are not currently incarcerated. And Section 6 is a conforming amendment to reflect the right of felons to vote under the circumstances provided in Section 1. Section 7, Subdivision 1, requires the Chief Executive Officer of each state and local correctional facilities to designate an official within the facilities to provide the notice required under this section to inmates who have had their civil rights to vote restored. And Subdivision 2 of Section 7 requires notice of the restoration of the right to vote be provided to inmates being released from a correctional facilities. And then also there's a requirement for probation officers and supervised release agents to provide the notice for all offenders under correctional supervision for a felony offense. Subdivision 3 of Section 7 just stipulates the form and content of the notice of the restoration of the right to vote. Subdivision 4 provides that failure to provide notice as required under this section does not prevent the restoration of the person's civil rights. Section 8 is also a conforming amendment stating that Minnesota Statute Section 201.014, Subdivision 2A, governs the restoration of voting rights for persons whose right to vote has been lost due to a felony conviction. Section 9 repeals Minnesota Statute 2014 and requires the state court administrator to report to the Secretary of State certain information about persons convicted of a felony. And Section 10 provides that the bill is effective August 1, 2015, and applies to elections holdover on that date. And with that being said, I do have one amendment in order to make it conforming to the articulation of what's in the bill I've already outlined, Madam Chair.
We don't have that amendment yet, so we'll wait a minute to let it be passed out, and then if you could just run through it.
And when you're ready, Madam Chair, just let me know.
When you're ready, Senator Champion.
Thank you. These small changes that I'm going to talk about in the A4 amendment that I would like for this for someone to move for its adoption, lines 1.2 to 3.33 add several sections that amend various subdivisions in three statutes. These three statutes have to do with maintaining voter registration lists. In each section, the amendment changes the phrase "challenge due to a felony conviction" to the phrase "challenge due to incarceration for a felony offense."
So, Senator Champion, just to understand better, the language that we're amending was sections of statute that weren't reflective of the changes.
That is correct.
Okay.
And Madam Chair. And also line 3.34 to 4.2 do two things as well. First, it fixes a grammatical issue. And secondly, the amendment refers to an individual not currently being incarcerated instead of completing the term of incarceration for a felony offense. This change makes the language consistent with language elsewhere in the bill. So counsel had indicated that I need to make sure that was accurate. Line 4.3 to 4.4 adds language to the notice given to individuals that they must also meet other voter eligibility criteria. We just wanted to make that clear. And finally, lines 4.5 to 4.7 add to the effective date that required notices must be given to individuals released from incarceration on or after August 1st, 2015. Therein lies the amendment, the A4 amendment, that I would love for someone to move for adoption.
Senator Hayden moves the A4 amendment. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. So, Senator Champion, would you like to have your testifiers now?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would like to start with Hidden County County Attorney Mike Freeman. And again, I'm happy to see him. He wanted me to make sure that I mentioned, or he was going to mention, that he couldn't wear a sports coat today because of this injury that I would like to remind the committee that I had nothing to do with.
Madam Chair,
Mr.
members
Freeman,
of the committee.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me back, and I've already apologized to the chair. I'd have to apologize even more profusely to Senator Cohen, who I served with, who had never allowed me to testify without a tie and a coat on. So I'm glad Senator Cohen's not here. Madam Chair, members, this is a common sense form that should have been made a long time ago. As prosecutors, we try to do what we can to fight crime and to make sure the streets are safe. But we also are the civil attorneys for the election divisions in our county. And the present law is confusing, complex, expensive, and doesn't accomplish a purpose. You see, when a person is incarcerated, they should lose their right to vote, as they do. But when a person is out on probation or parole, they are beginning their reorientation to the community, and one of the most important rights that people have in the community is the right to vote. So I think it's the right thing to do for election judges. It's the right thing to do for prosecutors. But I think it's also, more importantly, the right thing to do for the people who have done their time. Under the present system now, there are all sorts of people who are on paper who vote. Most of them don't know they can't vote. And the statute as it's written requires that you have to know you can't vote and you vote anyway. We are required to investigate each and every case, which we do. And most of the ones brought to us, we don't charge in the first place. But even if we charge them, universally we ask for community service. And it's a brief period of time. And for what purpose are we wasting valuable public resources? Well, it's an antiquated concept that came in this state way back in 1910. And I've got to say, as a proud Minnesotan and elected official in this state for almost 30 years, you know, there's not too many things that North Dakota does better than we do. Well, this is one of them. And so I think this makes sense. We're, just to put it in a little perspective, after the 2008 election, you may recall that was kind of close and we had a six-month recall. We were presented by outside groups and others 1,600 cases to review, and we had to investigate them all. At the end result, we ended up prosecuting 26 people, but we had to do all that investigation. It cost us nearly $1 million in investigators and attorney, not to speak of court time. In the criminal justice business, we like to have bright lines. We like to be able to tell people what they can do and what they can't. If they can't vote while they're incarcerated, and they can when they're not incarcerated. A bright line, it makes sense. Madam Chair, I urge its adoption and appreciate Senator Champion and lots of the folks here who have been championing this for a long time. It's, if I may, it's the right thing to do.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. I just want to note for the record that the statute used to be that you had to investigate any instances of voter fraud that came before you, and we did, this committee and the legislature did change that to try to make it a little bit easier on you and to more accurately reflect what is happening. So just, and I'm sure you know that too, but I just want you to know that we're doing our work here and trying to stay on top of all these election issues.
And Madam Chair, we appreciate that, but like you, I'm an elected official. And I don't want to be attacked by saying I'm, quote, soft on those people who are trying to violate our voting franchise. Frankly, these people aren't. And by the way, it's interesting enough, I have to report since you gave me the opportunity. In 2008, all this review was because they suggested there was voter fraud. When we were done, my former colleague and good friend, Senator Fritz Kanak, on behalf of Senator Coleman, said there was no election fraud in 2008. We were looking for it. We couldn't find it. So, again, we spent a lot of time and money. Thank you, Madam Chair, for what you did before. But let's clean this up and let's vote.
Any questions for Mr. Freeman? Thank you very much, Mr. Freeman, for coming.
You,
we appreciate your support.
Madam Chair, just a quick comment in regards to the context of since Mr. Kanak's name has been brought up here, I've had a discussion with him in regards to that. His comment at that time was a very narrow comment, not used and construed to be a very large, broad comment. He was referring in particular to a recount. And in a recount, only the votes cast and counted are considered. And in that context, I believe that for the ballots that are in the box, do you count them right? That's what he was referring to.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. The next testifier is Brian Rehm. Is he in the audience? Welcome to the committee, sir. Please pronounce your name correctly if I did not.
You pronounced it correctly. It's Brian Rehm.
Great. Please proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Well, thank you. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I can speak as an impacted individual. I grew up in a good family. I saw my parents go to work, pay their bills, pay taxes, and vote. But I made some mistakes in middle school. A lot of kids do. But drugs got their hooks in me at a pretty early age. And it shaped my decisions into my early adult life. I got in trouble very young. In fact, I was went to prison at 19 years old. All surrounding drugs. And I needed help. I didn't get that help until a little later on in life. But the weight of the mistakes that I made had carried on for long after I was able to straighten out. I've been sober for 5 years, and I even work at a drug and alcohol treatment center today. I wasn't able to vote until last year. And I have been unable to be that example. My parents were for me to my children until sometime later than I first saw that example. So if I can offer anything towards this conversation, that would be it.
Thank you, Mr. Rehm. We appreciate you taking the time and offering your testimony to us.
You're welcome.
In support of the bill. Thank you, buddy. The next person on the list is Demetria Carter. Welcome to the committee, ma'am. If you could just please state your name at the beginning and then proceed with your testimony.
Okay, thank you. My name is Demetria A. Carter. I'm from Eagan, and I am a member of Greater Friendship Missionary Baptist Church and a member of Isaiah. Everyone has a story, but some stories are never told because a person feels that they are unacceptable in the community and shameful in God's eyes. Although this is very difficult for me, here is my story. I am a proud graduate. I'm sorry.
I'm a proud graduate of McAllister College and the mother of two young adult children who are also college graduates. They are the most intelligent, beautiful, smart, and wonderful kids in the entire state. That's the only joke I have. I led a very normal life with all of the busyness. I had kids' activities, figure skating, I was a hockey mom, PTA, choir, booster club, Sunday school teacher. And I had a full-time job. I was a great mother and a great wife. Then for some reason it all fell apart. And I didn't know why for a long time until I was diagnosed with a severe mental illness and it caused me an addiction, a shopping addiction. This shopping addiction led me to make a mistake that I am not proud of. I misused my company credit card. I started with small items, but as the mental illness grew worse, my shopping grew worse. Eventually, it all caught up with me, and I served 79 days in the Hennepin County Adult Detention Center. The truth is that only three people in my church know my secret. I kept it from my children for 5 years, and I never shared it in my community because of all of my shame and guilt. I made a mistake, but I paid for it. I have put my life back together and created a new me. I have learned to control my mental illness through treatment and medication. With Isaiah's support, I am finding God's way through my darkness. Restoring the right to vote for me and others like me is essential to restoring my human dignity, to being an active part of my community, because my life matters. Even though I have served my time and have been accountable, I am on parole for 10 years. I will be 60 years old this year, and I cannot vote for 10 years because I served 79 days. Where's the justice and redemption in that?
Anything else?
No.
Ms. Carter, thank you so much for sharing your story. I hope you understand that by providing testimony in support of this bill, you're helping to, if the bill is enacted into law, you're helping to better others' lives. So we appreciate your time and the sharing of your own personal story.
Thank you.
Are there any questions from the committee? The next person on the list is Walter Hudson.
Mr. Hudson couldn't make it, so could we go to Carl Eggers?
Certainly. Mr. Eggers.
I made this joke the last time one of his colleagues came. I said he would sit to my right on top of that. Cause it's with
Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Carl Eggers, first name Carl with a K, last name Eggers, E-G-G-E-R-S. And I'm the executive director of Liberty Minnesota, which is a grassroots network of liberty and conservative activists involved in any political party and affiliation and getting the word for liberty out to the people of Minnesota. As a Republican, I'd be remiss if I didn't seek out the counsel of our founding fathers when considering a modern issue. Thomas Jefferson, per usual, didn't disappoint. He wrote in the Declaration of Independence that governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from consent of the governed. I think it should be notable that he did not write that governments derive their powers from the consent of those who haven't been caught in possession of a smokable green plant. Restoring voting rights to felons out on parole or probation is quintessentially American, as the principle of taxation without representation rings as true today as it did 240 years ago. If you consider the founding fathers themselves were rebellious criminals of their day, they still demanded the right to vote, as anyone in our society, any citizen of this country, should demand as well. But it doesn't have to be that dramatic. This issue has incredible bipartisan support, as you can see from this table and everyone here, from Senator Peterson, Chamberlain, Senator Thompson, and all those involved in this excellent coalition that Senator Champion and others have created. This is a bipartisan issue, not only in Minnesota, but throughout the nation. Senator Rand Paul and Senator Harry Reid recently introduced the Civil Rights Voting Restoration Act of 2015 in the United States Senate. This bill would allow nonviolent offenders on probation to vote in federal elections after 1 year. That's a few steps towards the right direction, but here in Minnesota, we can go get to the core of it and do even better. Voting transcends any political label that we ascribe to, be it left or right, Republican or Democrat, unaffiliated, whatever you have. We all expect that everyone should have the right to vote. I've heard from a lot on the right that probation is a part of the sentence, that probation is another phase of a felon's sentence from incarceration up through 10, 20 years or more down the line. Not only is this, I think, factually wrong and misplaced, it's historically wrong. Probation was never intended to be a nearly lifelong sentence for somebody or a scarlet letter, as we've seen today. Back in the 18th century, probation was designed to be a rehabilitative measure to get people out of prison, to get people back into the neighborhoods that they should be, while giving them the chance to get their life back on track. We expect those on parole and probation to be good neighbors, but we expect them to have no say over their neighborhood. How does that make any sense, regardless of what political party you're from? I like to also think that if our criteria for voting rights is only for those who've never made a mistake in their past, I don't think it's a stretch to say most of us in this room would be disenfranchised. Again, this is an incredible bipartisan issue. I'm excited to work with people that I've never had a chance to work with before, but will do so in the future. This is not a left-right. This is just an issue of love and of redemption and of second chances. I'd like to thank the committee today for hearing me speak. I'd like to thank the Restore the Vote Coalition for including Liberty, Minnesota as part of this coalition. We're working with all our activists and talking to groups that maybe you all haven't talked to, and reaching out to those to reconsider what does the voting right mean to us as American citizens. Thank you for your time, and I hope that you encourage civic involvement as Senate File 355 encourages it.
Thank you, Mr. Eggers. Questions for him from the committee? Thank you. The next person on the agenda is Grace Wachlerowitz. I'm sorry, Grace, you're going to have to repronounce your last name for us. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's Wachlerowitz. That's how I was taught by my husband, and I'm sticking with it. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Grace Wachlerowitz, and I am the chair of the Election Committee for the League of Minnesota Cities. You have heard compelling testimony on restorative justice components of Senate File 355. On behalf of the League, I would like to address the election administrative perspective regarding the restoration of voting rights of an individual who, upon release from incarceration. The League fully supports Senate File 355, as the voting rights of felons would be clear and understandable to the election judges, to the voter who has been convicted of a felony, and for election administrators. It eliminates the uncertainty related to the interpretation of the sentence status, notification issues, the challenge process that is administered by the election judges, and the lack of timely information related to the individual status. Furthermore, this proposed legislation will enhance the integrity of the election process, as it eliminates the need to question eligibility or an investigation by local law enforcement to those who have unknowingly registered to vote or did vote. The felon challenge process is intimidating and complex for both the voter and the election judge. The registered voter roster used in the polls on election day is produced 20 days prior to the election. This increases the probability that the voter status is not current, producing the following chain of events. The roster judge sees the felony challenge notation, discreetly and respectfully explains the challenge notation to the voter, and then contacts the head judge to complete the challenge process, determine voter eligibility. The eligibility to vote is taken seriously by both the election judges and the voters. If the roster is not current or the voter does not understand their rights, both the election judge and the voter wants to have the confidence of following the law. The head election judge therefore contacts the local election administrator, who in turn contacts the county for further clarification and confirmation. Many counties, not all, but some, make arrangements to have a qualified staff person from the court system available to answer these questions. However, this only occurs in state and federal general elections. I have been in elections for over 20 years, and I have personally experienced this scenario. Over 10 years ago, I did receive that phone call regarding a felony notation and talked to both the head judge and the voter. The voter's rights were restored, but the notation was still listed on the roster. It took approximately 10 to 15 minutes to confirm the voter status with the county. I can tell you that both the voter and the election judge were very uncomfortable. The voter expressed embarrassment by having to admit his felony conviction and only wanted to participate in the electoral process. Later, the election judge shared that this discomfort was felt by all the election judges and even the voters, wondering why this individual was pulled aside for further assistance. Another experience occurred during in-person absentee voting. Again, the voter had a felony notation. I contacted the county, but since the notation was still on file, the only confirmation would be the voter's oath of eligibility. The voter indicated that the probation officer did notify him that his voting rights were restored. It is unknown why the system was not updated. Perhaps there is a time lag in updating this system. Nevertheless, the voter did not want to risk voting unlawfully. Very upset, the voter left to resolve this issue. These are common examples. It creates undue stress in maintaining the integrity of the election. The majority of roster notations are to clarify and confirm the voter's record. Regardless if there is a notation, election judges and voters alike expect that all individuals are treated with privacy, dignity, and respect. Finally, as Madam Chair had indicated, I wish to reiterate the findings of the Election Integrity Task Force that was commissioned by Governor Mark Dayton in 2012. This task force did review other laws regarding the issue of voting rights. I'm trying to be brief here. They did indeed recommend the North Dakota model, which is comparable to Senate File 355. Thank you for your consideration of Senate File 355, and I would be happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you, Ms. Wachlerowitz. Senator Carlson?
No questions.
I just would like to emphasize that your comments, especially, and I remember this from the task force information I received afterwards, that as we think about administering elections in this committee, there is quite a big concern, or the reason that I'm supportive of this bill from one angle is how it eases some of the election administration for the election judges and especially the head election judges who have to mark the roster and keep track of that information. So thank you for speaking to that. I'd also call attention to members in your packet. There is a letter from Mr. Schrader from Common Cause. He wants to testify on this bill, but there is a letter of support from his organization. Senator Champion, let me ask, are there others in the audience who wish to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 355?
Madam Chair, I don't see anyone, but I would like to openly thank Sarah Walker, and I want to thank Mark Hasse. I want to thank Knock. I want to thank Ben Swigert from the County Attorney's Office, and, of course, my legislative assistant who's had to, you know, talk to all these various groups as well, Joni McAfee. And something that I think Mr. Egger said that really resonates with me, all of what he said really resonates with me, but something in particular. He says that this bill is a demonstration and really is about love and redemption and second chances. And I think that's really what it's all about. How do we create a pathway and an opportunity for individuals who may have made a tough decision in their life to be on a pathway towards productivity? And I'm reminded of the fact that you know, all of us have fallen short at some time. And if we had a light that glares on many of us, we would have some shame, right? But I'm glad that even Ms. Carter got a chance to come forward and use her experience as a way to help guide public policy. So with that being said, I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee has.
Is there discussion from the committee members? We're going to great, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Champion, I really want to thank you for bringing this forward. This is actually what I think is very deep in my heart, is to have people participate in their government. And I think one of the best things said was that the government derives its power from the people who are governed. And I think that is something that we all need to recognize. You're not forcing anyone to vote. That's an important thing to know, too. But when you prevent someone from voting, that's a problem. That's a problem for me. So I really thank you for doing this. Everyone who gets who is so-called, what you said before, might still be on paper, has a better future ahead of them. And I think this will help them recognize that and become a participant in our government.
Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Champion. As you know, we've had long conversations about this. I just want to thank you for not only bringing this bill forward, but also bringing a coalition of people that I don't know if I can remember in the time of my legislature of members of both sides of the aisle and citizens that have come and braved the snow to really stand up for this bill, as well as our local government partners. So I just want to say thank you for doing such an admirable job at being open and accessible and allowing everybody to participate in this. I do think, as Senator Carlson has said, that this is really kind of what we all kind of strive for, and a lot of reasons why many of us have come here to serve in the legislature. So once again, I'm fully supportive of the bill, and I am so glad that we've been able to have this discussion this year in the legislature.
Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 355 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is recommended to pass.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Senator Champion. The next bill on the agenda shouldn't take too long. It's Senator Eakin's Senate File 492. And
the millionaire stabbing the bus.
Why?
Just because. You gotta like Newman.
Not correct.
You gotta like Newman.
That judiciary class. I try to avoid that like the plague.
You missed it.
Have you ever been in that committee?
Yeah, we brought
it shops you up.
But you know what? I brought them donuts after it. Did you hear about that?
I didn't get up. I didn't.
Because you got up and left. And you and Bobby Joe beat me up.
Cheer
you two. Newman is the only one, see? Gotta like Newman.
Hi. So,
you don't like this?
To the public, if you could just file out quietly, unless you're interested in hearing about this next bill, we want to conclude in a timely manner. Senate File 492, Senator Eakin I noted in our last committee that I had a concern that because your bill is creating a new process for redistricting, that it wasn't clear in the legislation when a plan is presented to the legislature, if the legislature rejected it, or I'm sorry, if they approved it, but the governor wanted to weigh in, what process was there. And so the A1 amendment that you brought forward that members now have attempts to clarify that under your proposal, the redistricting plan is still subject to the requirements of the Constitution, which outline that the bills that are presented to the legislature need the approval of the governor.
And Madam Chair, that was certainly the intent of the bill, is that it would be subject to the governor's signature or veto. That was never intended to be left out, and I think it's good that we have the clarification to make sure that that's understood. And so I would move the A1 amendment or answer any questions that you may have on it first.
Is there any discussion on this?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Eakin, the last time you were here, we had a discussion about the potential for any redistricting plan to be challenged in court. And I believe it is the responsibility of the legislature, at least to, in the past, to make redistricting plans according to the Minnesota Constitution. But every time each party has done it, they've all gotten challenged. Maybe not all, but at least the ones in recent memory have been. And I don't think, even though this is giving direction to this panel to make a redistricting plan in accord with the Minnesota Constitution, that's what courts are really for, to define and decipher what is the appropriate plan if someone contests it. So I can understand why this has to be in your bill, but I don't think it's going to be lessening any impact of anyone challenging any plan by the panel in the future.
Sorry, you can.
And Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, certainly there's still the opportunity to challenge, as you said, and I'm sure there will still be challenges even if this does move forward. But my thought is it probably lessened the amount of challenges, because we're having a panel of retired judges who are going to be drawing up these redistricting plans. My guess is that it has a better chance of standing up in court because of that, and it's going to be subject to less potential for things like gerrymandering and things of that nature, which would give rise to legal challenges more so than a less partisan, more objective proposal for redistricting. So I think that it results in a stronger product that could probably withstand challenges more so than one that's drawn up in a more partisan, less objective fashion.
So, Senator Eakin, to press this a little bit further, as outlined on page 3, it says that if there is a first plan is submitted and rejected by the legislature, the commission shall submit a second plan within 2 weeks to the legislature again. But I'm assuming that with your A1 amendment, that means the legislature and the governor, if I'm not mistaken, because the plan is now being submitted in bill form. And that's where I was getting caught up in the previous committee, was that it just talked about submitting the plan, not a bill, to both bodies of the legislature. So I want to be clear that the intention and what this language is saying, and council can help clarify, is that the plan that's submitted by the retired judges goes to both bodies of the legislature. And then if they approve it and the governor rejects it, either on the first or second pass, it still doesn't become the new redistricting plan. Because each time the plan is submitted, that's like submitting a bill, and it has to be approved by the governor.
That is correct, Madam Chair, yes.
Is there any other discussion on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, Senator Ekin moves that A1 amendment to Senate File 492. Oh, wait, did we remember?
Is it A1? I don't have it. Thanks.
Okay. So all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So now, Senator Ekin, do you have any closing comments on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just that again, I think this is a better way for us to be redrawing the district lines, and I hope for your support.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak in favor or in opposition to Senate File 492? Seeing none, Senator Ekin move, or I'm sorry, seeing none. All those in favor of Senate File 492 as amended, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion prevails and the bill is recommended to pass.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
To the Rules Committee. So thank you very much, Senator Ekin, and members. With that, the committee is adjourned.